this story is sounding familiar, Carrie, because didn't Jeff Sessions face an embarrassment earlier in the year when it was revealed that he had met with the Russian ambassador, and he had to explain that he didn't think that that was campaign-related or was serious, but of course this time he's got a meeting that he didn't seem to remember that was explicitly part of the campaign, right?
For people close to Jeff Sessions, this is a mark of how busy he was and how, in their view, insignificant some of these people were with whom he was meeting. For Democrats and other folks who are more alarmed by the allegations concerning Russia, this is too many things, they say, to keep forgetting, and there has to be some kind of accounting of that in his testimony today and his conversation with the American public.
Okay, so we mentioned that Sessions has recused himself from overseeing the Russia investigation, which his boss has said repeatedly he's unhappy about. And the president has gone on to make more recent remarks that he's frustrated that as president of the United States, he's not supposed to interfere with the workings of the Justice Department. That's the way it's always been. He wishes it weren't that way and wishes there were things he could do. Could that be part of today's discussion?
Yeah, for Democrats and Justice Department veterans of both political parties, these boundaries with the White House are a real worry. There's a lot of examples, Steve. And in fact, President Trump has said repeatedly he wants the Justice Department to investigate his political opponent, Hillary Clinton. Last night, on the eve of this hearing, the Justice Department said they have directed senior federal prosecutors to evaluate whether they should name another special counsel to investigate what they call, quote, alleged unlawful dealings at the Clinton Foundation.
Whether it's putting up the Ten Commandments in his courthouse or in the state judicial building, or, you know, resisting the federal court ruling that required states to acknowledge gay marriage. So I think that for a significant set of Alabama voters, the fact that national leaders are criticizing their candidate doesn't make them like him any less. I will say, though, Roy Moore is a polarizing figure in the Alabama Republican Party. And one of the things I think is really important to remember is the last time Roy Moore ran for statewide office, this was 2012, and he was elected to be Chief Justice of the Alabama State Supreme Court. He got 51.7% of the vote, so he really just barely won.
He eked it out,
and that's a very low total for a Republican in Alabama. So he is a weak, among Republican candidates, he's a weak candidate. He's polarizing. The business community does not like him. It's more the rural Christian evangelical base that really supports him. Those people are, maybe half or more than half the party, but maybe more importantly, they come out and vote.
So their
turnout is great.
Why is Roy Moore such a polarizing figure? What do you see in him that makes him so divisive?
He is supported, I guess, because of his entire career has been based on being sort of an extreme, taking his Christian views and trying to implement them through law. And that really appeals to, a certain segment of Alabama voters. I would say, you could say it's somewhere around half of the Republican voters, but it turns off about half the voters who would like Alabama to be more integrated with the rest of the country. They want to, I'm thinking economically integrated. They want businesses to want to locate in Alabama, and they view him as turning people off from Alabama.
If you're just joining us, we are discussing the latest revelations on the situation regarding Roy Moore. He is the Republican Alabama Senate candidate accused of sexual misconduct. A fifth woman has come forward and saying that Moore had assaulted her when she was a teenager. Moore has denied any wrongdoing. We're with Joe Smith, who is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Alabama, and looking at the revelations that have come forth here in this race. Senate Majority Leader says Roy Moore should bow out of the race. He was asked about it and the future of that election in Alabama. Let's listen to what he said.
I did. I think he should step aside.
Are you encouraging a write-in campaign with Senator Strange?
Yeah, that's an option we're looking at. whether or not there is someone who could mount a write-in campaign successfully.
That question there about a write-in candidate, is that the answer if Roy Moore doesn't step aside?
Boy, I mean, again, it's an answer if the Republican, the National Republican Party wants to distance itself from Roy Moore. But I think that there's a very significant proportion of Alabama Republicans who are looking forward to voting for Roy Moore, who believe that these allegations are a hatchet job by the national news media against their sort of local hero. And so I would be shocked if a write-in campaign resulted in a victory for Luther Strange or any other Republican candidate. So what I suspect would happen then is you know, instead of getting close to 50% or more than 50% of the vote, Roy Moore would get something like 30% of the vote, the write-in candidate would get 15%, and the Democratic candidate would get the balance.
What has Roy Moore's campaigning looked like up to this point in Alabama?
It hasn't been very visible. He's been talking to, you know, small sort of closed groups, chambers of commerce and religious groups, as far as I can tell. But he hasn't been taking a lot of appearing in a lot of venues where people could ask him questions. And that is certainly the case since these allegations were made about a week ago now.
And he's saying these allegations are a witch hunt. He says this is staged, has been staged weeks before the election to undermine his race. How do we know whether that is true?
Well, I think, you know, you read these news stories and these are not anonymous sources. You've got people who are willing to give their names and say, this happened to me. One woman yesterday who was willing to appear on video. I think it's hard to imagine that there's some incentive for these women to lie about it. It doesn't seem to me that their lives have gotten better since they've done it. I mean, they've been sort of vilified and badgered. So, how do you know whether anything is true is a good question, but you have lots of different points, lots of different individuals who are either asserting or corroborating that these things happen. So, I don't know how you know whether anything is true, but there seems to be a lot of evidence for this.
What has, since these allegations came out, what have the Democrats done in the race? What has the Democratic position been on Roy Moore in Alabama?
Well, basically for weeks before this, one of the talking points of the Democratic Senate candidate has been that Roy Moore is an embarrassment. Roy Moore embarrasses the state, and the Democratic candidate won't embarrass the state. Since then, they've largely tried. I think he's not emphasized this. He's really kept saying, I'm still talking about issues. I'm talking about health care and I'm talking about jobs. The only way, as far as I know, that Doug Jones has responded directly is by saying these are serious charges and Roy Moore needs to answer them. But I think, while your enemies while your opponents are disintegrating, you want to stay out of the way, and that's what they've been trying to do.
The new accuser, Beverly Young Nelson, told a packed news conference in New York yesterday that Roy Moore attacked her when she was a teenager and he was a prosecutor in Alabama. Meanwhile, over on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell declared, "I believe the women." Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado said that the Senate should vote to expel Moore. What do you think? 800-642-1234. Is it time for Roy Moore to give up? When should people running for office sacrifice their own elections for the benefit of the party? 800-642-1234. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return after a news update. Republicans across Congress unleashed forceful condemnations, urging Alabama Senate nominee Roy Moore to abandon his campaign. But with no sign that he will heed their calls, GOP leaders were less clear last night on what should be done next if Moore is elected next month. multiple scenarios, from expulsion to write-in candidacies to holding hearings, were brought up in Congress in light of a fifth woman coming forward accusing Moore of sexual misconduct. We're discussing the situation with University of Alabama political science chair Joe Smith. Your thoughts on it as well, 800-642-1234. What should the GOP do about Roy Moore? Do allegations against candidates mean anything, or does someone need to be convicted of a crime for the accusation to matter? Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Byron in Madison. Hi, Byron.
Hi. I'm calling to say that basically all news can't be fake. I've seen in New York Times that a lot of his constituents say that this news is fake. And that is not real. What I'm asking is for Democrats, the leading Democrats, to stay out of it and allow the Republicans to actually handle this, because they could use that against them. So that's all I have to say.
Byron, thanks for calling. And he's recommending that Democrats take the high road, Joe.
Yeah, I think that's what that's what they're trying to do right now, because they don't want to seem like they're trying to capitalize to make political hay out of what is frankly, terrible misfortune and that these women have suffered, right? They don't want to be trying to be seen as capitalizing on that. And I think it's just they want this to stay in the news cycle. They want the news cycle to be Republicans trying to decide whether to continue to support Roy Moore, not Democrats, throwing fuel on the fire.
What about, as Byron brought up, the whole element of fake news, people thinking this isn't true?
Yeah, I think that as there are more stories that come out and even more stories from Roy Moore's hometown of Gadsden, that there were people who saw this kind of behavior, not assault, but they saw Roy Moore being interested in teenagers even when he was, around 30 or in his early 30s, then that the idea that it is fake news is harder and harder to maintain. So you've got, you had Mo Brooks, who is a congressman from Alabama, say, I think last night, that the Republican agenda in Congress is far more important than 40-year-old allegations of misconduct. So that's sort of implicitly conceding that it's true, but that it's not important enough to change the race.
Is this a sample of the political clashing that's happening all over the country, or is this unique to Alabama?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think one of the points I'd make is if Doug Jones does win this seat, then it's going to be the first time in 25 years or something that Alabama has elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate, and people are going to say, "Oh, Alabama is turning," or "Oh, this is a sign of civil wave." I think it's more signs. I would be very cautious about that. Roy Moore is an unusually weak candidate among Republicans. He got the nomination because people felt that his opponent in the runoff, Luther Strange, had gotten his job, had been appointed by the preceding governor so that Luther Strange would stop investigating that governor. So that person had Luther. There were some negative views about Luther Strange. And then, you've got Roy Moore's supporters who are very ardent supporters and who do come out to vote. This is an unusual situation. So I wouldn't read much about the national political climate out of the results of this race.
Let's go to Becky in Oshkosh. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I think any of them should be prosecuted if they have misconduct. But I just don't feel we didn't hold Trump to that standard when his allegations were made against him. I think they all need to be held to a standard. When they're in office.
So yeah, and Becky brings up President Trump's sexual misconduct. Joe.
Well, as far as prosecuting this, these things that we've heard about so far took place long ago. There was at that time a statute of limitations on sexual assault, and that statute has passed. That time has passed. So, from what we know right now, Roy Moore is not going to face any criminal prosecution. Certainly, the one thing that is kind of interesting is that he claimed he was going to sue the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. I will be shocked if that happens, because if he does sue the Washington Post, then he would be put under, you know, he would be deposed under oath. And at that point, if he says things that are not true, he does, you know, bring the possibility of criminal prosecution into play. But as you know, I agree with her that people should be held accountable for these kinds of actions. It's not going to be by the criminal justice system, though.
So as you watch this race as it's playing out, what are you looking for? What are you watching and keeping tabs of in the context of elections in Alabama?
Well, I guess I'm looking. I don't see Roy Moore dropping out just because the party wants him to. My guess is the only situation in which Roy Moore would drop out is if he thought it was personally advantageous to him, if damage to his reputation or other damages to himself got to be so great that he thought he was damaging himself and maybe his ability to make money in the future, by continuing. Roy Moore is not a team player for the Republican Party. As far as the other candidate, it's just hard to know. I mean, I'm looking at polls. Every poll that comes out, I like to look at. The polling, most recent poll that I've seen showed Doug Jones with a slight lead, not a lead that was still within the margin of error, so not a significant lead. But I'm going to be looking for more polling and, you know, looking to see how Roy Moore campaigns. He really, I think, doesn't want to answer questions from the media about these things. So he's got to have very controlled places to campaign. And I would think that is going to sort of hamstring his campaign.
Well, Joe, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, this was fun.
Joe Smith is chair of political science at the University of Alabama. He received his undergraduate degree at UW-Madison, and we've been discussing the Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore and the sexual allegations leveled against him as a fifth woman has come forward accusing him of sexual misconduct. The latest news often arrives to your smartphone via a thought bubble. They're called push alerts, and they provide short bursts of the day's developments. We're now exploring the world of push alerts with two writers from Slate. Their new piece is called The Year in Push Alerts: How Breaking News Became Our Lives. Laura Bennett is features director for Slate. She's also written for The New York Times, Bloomberg, Business Week, and The New Republic, among other publications. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
And Allison Benedict is Slate's executive editor. Allison, welcome to you.
Hi.
Well, The New York Times, its most swiped push alert notification of 2017 so far, as of early October, that came our way on July 21st. Laura, can you tell us about that push alert?
Sure. So, I mean, to clarify just overall, this package, the idea of it was to sort of show, it opened with a big interactive that featured all the push alerts the New York Times had sent over the year. And we wanted to show how kind of assaultive and anxiety-inducing and overwhelming the year overall felt when you were being pelted with breaking news every few minutes. So as part of this package, we did this piece where we had our tech reporter interview Times and Washington Post editors about how the sort of push alert sausage gets made, so to speak. And so the top alert of the year was about Spicer leaving the White House, and it was that Spicer's firing, and it was, I think, if I recall correctly, that it ambiguously alluded to Trump's hiring as a new communications director. And so what the editors of the paper said is that they thought this alert was so swiped both because it was astonishing that Spicer was out and also because everyone wanted to know what the deal was with this new guy Trump had hired. And of course, it ended up being Anthony Scaramucci, who drove a sort of preposterous and self-contained news cycle for the next 2 weeks. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
And Allison, you write in the opening section of this package the sentence, "For all of our polarization and our partisan bubbles, this inability to detach from the news is something we've experienced together." Why does that matter?
Well, I don't necessarily mean it in like this heartwarming "we are all one America" way, but I do think that this year, regardless of your politics, has been like no other, certainly in my lifetime, and I think probably even in my parents' generation, there may have been just as newsy spans of time, but there wasn't social media and there wasn't this constant, there wasn't the technological capability to reach us wherever we are at any moment. And so I do think that we all experience together, regardless of how we feel about Trump, regardless of how we feel about, you know, anything that's going on in the country at any time, this like wake up in the morning, there's news, get to work, there's news, constant feeling. I'm sure there are plenty of people, and maybe some of your listeners who will call in, that have successfully detached in a healthy way, or have detached in maybe a way that's burying their heads in the sand. But I think a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have felt overwhelmed by breaking news, but not been able to stop engaging.
And Laura, the swipe-through rate on these push alerts is extremely high. I read somewhere like 90%. Do major news outlets now see push notifications as critical in their industry?
It's interesting. I hadn't read that exact statistic about the swipe-through rate. What I do know is that a lot of the papers, I mean, we in this particular piece that we're talking about focused on the New York Times and the Washington Post as the papers kind of on the front lines of this New Year's news cycle. Obviously, a lot of outlets, Slate included, have been experimenting with different kinds of push alerts. But the interesting thing about push alerts is that editorially, they make sense. I mean, it's a way to reach readers in an environment where sort of, I mean, obviously on their phones where their eyes are fixed all the time, but also it's a way to sort of speak to them in an environment where like the push alert feels very native to the iPhone lock screen. And so, you know, you have text messages and you have push alerts, and it sort of makes sense there. But it's hard to find. I mean, obviously, the one metric that really these papers prioritize is the swipe rate. And they said, what the editors have told us, that even when an alert doesn't have a very high swipe rate, they don't necessarily deem it a failure. They just think, you know, they're experimenting. So they think the quote we had in this piece was, there was the least swiped notification of the year was about Trump being scheduled to take his first foreign trip to the Middle East. And the editors were like, well, no one swiped through on that, but it wasn't a bad alert. It was just that this alert sort of had all the information you needed contained within it.
Oh, okay. So, Allison, it's the content, too, in these alerts, whether people need more information. What is the purpose here? What are we trying to do with these alerts? Is it to get just a bit of information? Is it to lure people to the website? Is it to prove you're the first at breaking news?
I think it's all of those things. I mean, again, in this piece where we talked to the New York Times and the Washington Post, they talked about, you know, as they're composing their push alert for whatever their breaking story is, they're also looking at their phones at the same time to make sure the, you know, competing outlet is not getting it first, whether that means breaking the story first or pushing it first. And they have also pushed stories that they haven't been quite ready to put up on their website. And you see this actually if you're on Twitter. You see reporters like breaking their stories on Twitter first, even if the story isn't up on their website quite yet. So there is like this extreme competitiveness between all outlets, but particularly this year between the two major national newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times. So I think the push alerts are some about that, and some, you know, publishers no longer have a ton of control about how their work reaches an audience because of Facebook and other, you know, social media sites. So this is one way to control it. This is one way to say, like, I am the New York Times and I am reaching you on your phone where you live. And I'm going to try to write this in a way that's incredibly compelling, that maybe is a little bit cute or funny, conversational, to get you to want to read more. They definitely experiment with tone. They talked a lot about how they play it less straight now, and they try to be chattier in their push alerts. So I think it's all of those things. It's an attempt to beat their competitors. It's an attempt to reach their audience. And in a way, I don't know if I would say it's an attempt to manipulate us. I don't think there's anything nefarious about it, but it does. I mean, certainly for me, I'm trained now to look at my phone, to swipe through. Like, that's just part of my day. So they've been pretty successful at it, I would say.
If you're
I'm an easy mark.
Easy target. If you're just joining us, we're talking about push alerts with two writers from Slate. Their new piece is called The Year in Push Alerts, How Breaking News Became Our Lives. Laura Bennett is with us. She's features director for Slate, as well as Allison Benedict, who is Slate's executive editor. You can join this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you allow push alerts to your phone? How do you use them? Why did you turn off push notifications? Was there a moment when you realized it was just too much? What's the best part of seeing push notifications? 800-642-1234. So, Allison, do you let push alerts come through on your phone or tablet? How do you reconcile push alerts now after writing this piece?
I do. And actually, it's funny. It hadn't exactly occurred to me to turn them off. And some of the reaction we got to this piece was exactly that, like, just turn your notifications off, you idiot. I can't do it. I won't do it. I think partly because of my job, I want to make sure I see whatever is breaking first. Partly, I don't know, because it's become part of, like, the normal routine of my life. But I think even if I were to turn off my notifications, and this was part of the idea behind the package that we ran as well, it's not just the push alerts. The push alerts were a good way for us to show, you know, the year in media exhaustion. But, like, sure, I could turn off my alerts, but that wouldn't mean that I wouldn't be sort of always checking to see what the latest news is or always assuming something's about to break. Like, that comes for me also from Twitter. That comes from, you know, cable news. That comes from just the regular internet and Facebook. Like, it's everywhere. So I don't think it's just push alerts. Even if I were to turn off those notifications, I still think I would be fairly attached to the breaking news cycle.
And Laura, before we go into news break here in the next few seconds, this media exhaustion, as Allison is referring to, have you a different relationship with push alerts now after this package?
That's a very good question. Do I have a different relationship with push alerts package? Yes, I think I feel more, there's like a new twinge of sort of self-flagellation that comes into play every time I look at a push alert. I'm like, ugh, I'm falling victim to them again.
And we're going to have to just leave it right there. News update is next.